among ordinary Gazans? Does that support extend to the West Bank, or is it strictly Gaza-oriented?
Hamas is a very complicated organization. It has a political wing. It's, as you say, it won an election in 2006 that made it the ruling power in Gaza, not in the West Bank. It has a social welfare contingent. It's what makes it possible for many of the poorest people in Gaza to survive beyond the UN. And it has an armed wing, which at times has carried out actions that are legal under international law, and on many occasions has carried out, as it did massively on October 7th, horrific criminal acts in violation of international law, because no one, including an occupied population, has the right to attack and kill civilians. So it's a complicated organization. The notion that we hear from the Israelis, we're going to wipe out Hamas. What does that even mean? You're going to wipe out members who voted, members of a party who signed on to vote for Hamas back in the last election, which was in 2006? You know, the question of how much support does Hamas have? It's the same question. How much support does Fatah have, the mainstream organization of the PLO that was the dominant political force in the West Bank, the dominant political force within the Palestinian Authority? The so-called president of the Palestinian Authority is also the leader of Fatah. And Fatah, like Hamas, they both had elections in 2006 for four-year terms. 13 years later, they're still the same people in office. They're old, they're decrepit, they don't have a whole lot of support from anyone in the context of elections. On the other hand, if you ask Palestinians, do you support Hamas as some abstraction? In some polls, up to 30% of Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, but in the West Bank as well, I don't know the figures for the West Bank, significant numbers will say, yeah, of all of them, they're the best. That's a pretty low bar. It's a pretty low bar because Palestinians tend to be very distant from their elected officials of all stripes, of all political stripes. I think that the complication is that Hamas isn't simply a militant military organization. It is a number of other things. And what has become clear is that the political wing and the humanitarian wing, the social welfare wing, had no advance information about what was planned in this attack of October 7th. The notion that Israel thinks they can wipe out Hamas simply doesn't make any sense. You know, you're talking about a political and economic and social welfare organization that is based within, of course, a civilian population. If a house is the house of someone who is an official in the social welfare department of Hamas, does that make them a legitimate target and their family, the babies, their grandchildren, their mother-in-law? Are they all legitimate targets? According to Israeli actions, the answer would be yes. According to international law, absolutely not. So that's sort of the complication that we see here.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was on Deutsche Welle on October 11th, and he talked about Hamas when Netanyahu was Prime Minister in the 1990s. This is what Olmert said. I'm quoting, "For years, Netanyahu explicitly preferred to deal with Hamas in order not to have to deal with the Palestinian Authority. Hamas was financed," Olmert still speaking, "Hamas was financed with the assistance of Israel for years with hundreds of millions of dollars that came from Qatar, with the full knowledge and support of the Israeli government led by Netanyahu," unquote. I dare say few know about Israel's connection with Hamas in this period.
It's interesting. It goes back even before that. It goes back to the period of 1987 when Hamas was founded in Gaza. It had its origins with the Egyptian-based Muslim Brotherhood, as you say, David, but it also, from the beginning, as Olmert is saying here, but Olmert also has his partisan view. He's saying this is all about Netanyahu. This actually began when Labour Party, when Rabin was in power, when others from the Labour Party were in power. So this isn't just a Likud or Netanyahu issue. What is true is that the support for the creation of Hamas as a legal institution in Gaza very much reflected what the U.S. did in Afghanistan when it helped to create the Mujahideen led by later Al-Qaeda leader. You know, so we have the rise of Al-Qaeda under U.S. sponsorship as one of a number of Mujahideen organizations that the U.S. thought would be very useful to fight against the Soviets. Similarly, the Israeli view was the PLO is really a problem right about now. We don't want to have to deal with them any more than we have to. What better way to get people to not support the PLO within the Palestinian population than to have an alternative, in this case, a religiously framed alternative of an Islamist organization? And Israel supported it and allowed it to thrive and allowed it to function legally at a time when PLO officials were being assassinated around the world. So this has a long and complicated history that goes back even before Netanyahu was the prime minister.
Ismail Haniyeh is the Hamas political leader, and he's quoted in The Guardian as saying, and I'm quoting, "Our objective is clear. We want to liberate our land, our holy sites, our Al-Aqsa Mosque, our prisoners." He then added to the enemy, addressing Israel, "We have only one thing to say to you. Get out of our land. There is no place of safety for you." Unquote. If you were an average Israeli and you heard that, you wouldn't be too excited about, you know, cuddling up with Hamas if there's no place and no safe place for you.
That's absolutely right. I wouldn't feel so good about that either, and I'm not an Israeli. I think what's important is to look at how the political and military and other leadership of Hamas and others in Hamas have changed their positions over the years. For many years, they refused to accept any acknowledgement of or negotiations with Israel. As it turns out, over the years, they have negotiated many times with Israel. Most recently, in a prisoner exchange, something that Israel does routinely. Unlike the U.S., Israel is very public about its willingness to negotiate for any prisoners or POWs left behind. There was one Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, who had been held by Hamas in Gaza for 5 years. The negotiations continued for most of that time. It took years. But at the end of it, Gilad Shalit was released to his family in return for the release of almost 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. There's no question that Hamas sees the taking of POWs as a way of getting their prisoners back. Is that legal? Not if it goes after civilians. Absolutely not. But is it understandable? Sure. It's the way you get prisoners released. And I think in this context, it's pretty clear that the Israelis see it the same way. In the last week, there have been over 5,000 more Palestinians, 4,000 of whom were workers from Gaza who had permits to be working inside Israel. They were all suddenly swept up and imprisoned. They almost doubled the number of Palestinian prisoners being held illegally in Israeli prisons. I say illegally because, number one, they're not being charged. Number two, it's illegal for an occupying power to transfer prisoners or transfer any civilians from the occupied population into the occupying country. It's simply illegal across the board. So imprisoning Palestinian prisoners from Gaza or the West Bank or occupied East Jerusalem to a prison inside Israel is by itself a violation of the Geneva Conventions, a war crime. So all of that is going on, and it's pretty clear that the reason Israel suddenly went after 4,000 more Gaza workers who had had permits to be in Israel is because it gives them more people. I think they're looking forward to a prisoner exchange of some sort, maybe with the currently held, illegally held, we should be clear, civilians and military people that are being held by Hamas. So this is a very complicated thing. There's no clarity on how this is going to be resolved.
We talked a little bit about the elite media. Let's continue along those lines. How shall I say it? The performance of the media, mainstream media coverage of the conflict. Veteran Mideast journalist and American University of Beirut professor Rami Khoury gave the media an F grade. He also advised, quote, CNN is bad for your health, unquote. Anderson Cooper, Wolf Blitzer, Aaron Burnett, Nick Robertson et al. Provide cheerleading for Israel. There's no history, no background, no context. They regurgitate IDF talking points. Embedded assumptions are never challenged. Israeli government spokespeople are featured time and time again. Palestinian voices are few and far between. Talk about that media coverage.
Well, I never disagree with Rami. Let's start with that. He is a brilliant analyst and a great media critic. I think he's right. They deserve an F. I would say that 5 years ago, they deserved an F minus. So I like to think of things in process. You know, if you don't, working on this issue, you never survive in this movement. You just don't. So I look at it in the context of what has changed. At the time of Operation Cast Lead, when Israel assaulted Gaza in 2008 and 9, one of the first things Israel tried to do, and was quite successful at doing, was keeping the international press out of Gaza. By now, they don't try to do that. I mean, they try a little bit, they announce it, but there's no real effort. Why? Because there are stringers for mainstream media outlets based in Gaza who were already there. That happened during Cast Lead. There was one young woman stringer from the New York Times based in Gaza. They couldn't do anything about her because she lived in Gaza. She lived with her parents. And she was great. And her stuff was on the front page for days, but a little tiny piece in a sea of pro-Israel assumptions and whatever. Now, that's quite different. We are hearing Palestinian voices. Some of that has to do with the work of an organization called IMEU, the Institute for Middle East Understanding, which started 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, they had one person on staff and had to struggle to get anybody to pay any attention to them. Now, they have a huge staff. I don't know how many are on it, but it's a lot of people. And they can't keep up with all the demands for assistance, for Palestinian voices. Who should we interview? How do we reach people in X refugee camp? It's an extraordinary difference. Now, is that going to reverse the decades, and it's multiple decades, of pro-Israeli assumptions within the U.S. press? Of course not. We can't be naive about this. But I also think to see it without the context is a mistake. It exists within a broader context of how much things have changed. So does there still need to be constant criticism of the U.S. press? Absolutely. Do we still need to target specific journalists who sound like they're spokespeople for the Pentagon or for the IDF? Absolutely. There are still plenty of them on very influential outlets. But there are also others. You now have different people that have come up, younger reporters who have come up in a different era, whose assumptions that they were learning about politics when they were in high school and they were in college and when they went to journalism school was not the same as those who went to high school and college and journalism school 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 40 years ago. So there are differences. And even among the most pro-Israeli voices, Tom Friedman, for God's sakes, has actually shifted a bit in terms of how he's seeing the situation on the ground. Because anyone who isn't completely unwilling to acknowledge what they see in front of them, what they see directly in front of their own eyes, has got to be recognizing that. And the notion that you can stand back and say, we don't need a ceasefire now, is actually not an easy thing to do. For politicians, it's easy because there's a history. You know, David, this notion of we don't need a ceasefire yet is a longstanding U.S. position. We saw this in 2006 when Israel was at war in Lebanon, when Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State for George Bush Jr., said explicitly, we don't need a ceasefire yet, when the Security Council was voting, but almost every other country on the council was saying, we need a ceasefire. This is crazy. This is desperate. We need a ceasefire. And her answer was, we don't need a ceasefire yet. And you have to read that as not enough people have died yet. We need more people to die. Maybe tomorrow. Maybe in a few days we can have a ceasefire. What will be different then, other than more people will have died? In 2008 and 9, during Cast Lead, The same thing at the United Nations, again, with Condoleezza Rice at the end of her term, the end of the Bush term. We don't need a ceasefire yet. But what happened this time? I mentioned earlier what happened in 2021, when President Biden now is saying we don't need a ceasefire. And suddenly there's pushback from members of Congress. And, you know, these are not members of Congress who necessarily actually support Palestinian rights. These are including people who have never said anything in support of Palestinian rights. But for their own human reasons and political reasons in terms of what this means for how the world perceives what the United States is all about, for all of those reasons, they're prepared to say, we need a ceasefire. Even if they start and end their letter with, Israel has the right of self-defense to do whatever it wants and we should pay them as much as they want for whatever they need. They say all of that, but in the middle of it, they say, we need a ceasefire. That's huge. Is it enough? Of course not. Have we done enough work with those members of Congress and their staff? No, we haven't. But it is huge that they are now saying that there is a resolution calling for a ceasefire now, that members of Congress are saying, maybe they won't sign on to the resolution, but they will call for a ceasefire. Or if not, if that word has become too toxic, they will say, I will call for a cessation of hostilities. It means the same thing. Fine, use whatever language you want, but call for a ceasefire because that's what's so desperately needed. And that's where we have seen a change. It's not enough of a change. Rami is right, they still get an F. Congress gets an F minus minus because they have more power. But nonetheless, it is changing. It is changing.
Acquisition of land by force is an undisputed part of international law, as is collective punishment. The latter is a long-time Israeli practice. Homes are blown up. East Jerusalem and the Syrian Golan Heights have been annexed by Israel in flagrant violation of international law. It rarely comes up in any kind of discourse. Large swaths of the West Bank have been taken for Israeli settlements. There are at least 500,000 settlers, it might be even more than that, on the West Bank. How does that portend for any kind of viable Palestinian state?
Well, the second part of your question, I think, is the easy one. There is no longer a possibility of a two-state solution. It's very clear. This is not a debatable issue at this point among anybody who knows anything. The two-state solution, or as it usually is called very quickly, the two-state solution with swaps, you have to say it very fast and you have to say with swaps, is something that exists for politicians and diplomats who have no answer, to what to do about the oppression of Palestinians, the apartheid facing Palestinians, the settler colonial reality of Israel. They have nothing to offer to solve that challenge. So instead they say, we need to get back to a two-state solution. There's not going to be a two-state solution because there's no land left for a viable, contiguous Palestinian state. Now, putting that aside, the question of annexation remains a very key one. And we did hear not too long ago some specific and terrifying realities about the occupation and now annexation of the Golan Heights. The annexation of the Golan actually was announced by Israel back in 1981, just a few years after it was occupied in 1967. It wasn't recognized by any country in the world. That changed in 2018. Donald Trump is president. He goes to Israel. He meets with Netanyahu and he says, I now declare that we recognize Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights as legitimate. It's like, who said you can do that in complete violation of international law? And no one calls him out on it. And worse, well, then he gets back to Jerusalem and he announces that the U.S. embassy is now going to be moved, again, in complete violation of UN resolutions and international law. He is going to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And he comes back to the United States and he meets with a group of wealthy Jewish Republicans, main donors of the Republican Party and of his campaign. And he looks around and he says, I, for the first time, recognized Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights. And then he says, and when I did, I was with your prime minister. And not one of them stood up and said, excuse me, Mr. President, we're not Israelis. We're Americans. We don't have a prime minister in Israel. Netanyahu's not our prime minister. You're our president. Nobody said that. It was the ultimate kind of anti-Semitic canard that says that Jews have dual loyalty to Israel. It was an outrage, and no one called him out on it that was in the room or in the mainstream press. Those of us outside of those arenas did. And then he went on in that same meeting, and he looked around, and he saw Sheldon Adelson, one of the wealthiest funders of the Republican Party and of Israeli occupation and settlement processes, and his wife. And he looked around and said, when he was talking about the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, recognizing U.S., essentially the U.S. was recognizing the annexation of Jerusalem, also illegal and recognized by no one. He said, Sheldon and Miriam, I did it for you. What could be a clearer acknowledgement that he is making his policy based on the desires of wealthy Jewish money? Exactly what Ilhan Omar was excoriated for anti-Semitism. When she talked about it as a phenomenon that some politicians will make their decisions based on money provided by different lobbies. And she mentioned the tobacco lobby, Big Pharma, a third one, and the Israel lobby. She mentioned four separate lobbies. But because it included the Israel lobby, she was excoriated for anti-Semitism. President Trump at the time makes an explicitly anti-Semitic reference to making his decision because his wealthiest donors wanted it, and nobody says a word. So it's an extraordinary thing, this whole notion of annexation. But whether it's pro forma annexation, meaning that they go through the motions of it, they're annexing that land, whether it's acknowledged or not, or de jure annexation, meaning it's legally announced, is really not very significant for the Palestinian lives that are uprooted from this. When people are thrown out of their land, their houses are demolished, their olive trees are uprooted, and they and their families are physically moved, forced out of their land. That's why there's no land left for a Palestinian state. Whatever we may have thought about independent Palestinian state alongside Israel, why it wasn't ever equal, et cetera, it doesn't really matter anymore. It's just not going to happen because it's not possible any longer. Whether it was just or not, it's not even the issue. The issue is there's no land left. Let's move on. The issue is now not about states. One state, two state, red state, blue state. That's not the issue. The issue is rights. Do we have equality and human rights for all, or do we not? What we have right now is a situation where the entire territory of what was once historic Palestine, the territory from the river to the sea, including the 1947-48 borders of Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, and occupied East Jerusalem, all of that together is under the control of one government and one military, that of Israel. And what rights people within that territory have is partly determined by where they are and their ethnicity, their religion, their language. That's the definition of apartheid. When populations in one territory ruled by one force, one government, have different levels of rights depending on issues like nationality, religion, ethnicity, language, etc. That's the definition of apartheid. That's why all the major human rights organizations in the world, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, B'Tselem, so many and several more in Israel, parts of the United Nations, have all determined that Israel is carrying out the crime of apartheid. That's not a complicated reality anymore. It's widely understood.
What can individuals do about the crisis in the Middle East?
Right now, the issue is ceasefire. That's the only issue that matters right this moment. We need all kinds of things, but right now, we need a ceasefire. That is the most urgent. There needs to be humanitarian aid. The hostages need to be released. There's all kinds of things. But first and foremost, we desperately need a ceasefire. That means calling over and over and over again to your congressperson's office. The protests all last week that was spearheaded by Jewish Voice for Peace that saw over 300 people being arrested saying Jews need a ceasefire now and included over 25 rabbis who were arrested in the Cannon office building. Those protests were all focused on the issue of ceasefire. And that discipline to be very clear about what has to happen right now is a matter of life and death. We need a ceasefire now, a ceasefire on all sides. It's the only way to stop the killing.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, David.
You were just listening to Phyllis Bennis, Ending Cycles of Violence, Israel and Palestine. I talked with her in late October. Phyllis Bennis, author and Middle East expert, is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and directs its new internationalism project. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Medea Benjamin, Vandana Shiva, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Phyllis Bennis, Ending Cycles of Violence, Israel and Palestine, and for the classic Noam Chomsky book on Israel and Palestine called Fateful Triangle, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Elizabeth Aronson, Manu Rafari, and KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
I teach my children about systemic racism and about historic and persistent colonialism and the responsibility that comes with their privilege. I will use my voice to speak up, and I will make more space at the table.
I will continue to educate myself and others in my community about the racism and inequities faced by BIPOC.
We will not be silent and idle.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.